Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and USA Today Network. I am Graham Couch of the Lansing State Journal, alongside my colleague Chris Solari from the Detroit Free Press. It has been a while, Chris, since we convened in this format. It's good to be back.
Yeah, early Tuesday morning, another after dark Spartan Speak. Doing well. The funny thing is, like, all those years that people heard me complaining about night football games, this is my prime time. It's always been my prime time. I mean, my kids are grown now. I can be up nights again. It's wonderful. It's more of my natural rhythm, which
grown as an 8-4 or whatever,
9.5 and 5.
Oh, wow.
So
wow. Holy smokes.
Yeah. Sleeping through the night, waking up in the morning for school, but hey, you know.
Well, I wish people could see the Zoom that we see each other on, because you are like a floating Dr. Evil head, and I took a screenshot of it. Maybe I'll tweet it out a little later.
I actually only get to see your chin, so.
Which one?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's from this angle, I should move my computer a little bit.
For someone who loves the high angle shot, that Zoom camera it's not flattering.
It's not doing me many favors. Well, there's a lot to get into. We're going to talk mostly hoops here. We may talk a little bit sort of reaction to Michigan's national championship and what that means for the Spartans and some other things. But so we'll get into that a little bit. Maybe tease some hockey. Next week, I think maybe we'll have Nate Bott on to talk some hockey. I am going to, I think as of now, I am skipping the Maryland basketball trip this weekend to go to both Michigan and Michigan State hockey games to write off of those.
It's a hot story. About this week, and having followed that team really all the way back when I was covering when Ron Mason was the coach and kind of watching that program at its height and at its bottom, it's very not just interesting but welcoming to see it coming back and seeing the fan interest coming back and seeing the interest as a whole coming back. I actually went to the Frozen Four because we didn't have anybody on staff at the Free Press who had covered college hockey before. When Michigan was there a couple years ago, I went to Boston and covered it, and it was good to get back in that. But Michigan State was always going to be a conversation piece in the college hockey world, as small as that is. Going to Boston for that Frozen Four, there were a lot of Michigan State people there, and they were itching and really wanting to get to the point where the program was relevant again, and Adam Nightingale's really pushed it beyond just relevance right now. I mean, the top four in the pairwise could be a potential number one seed once the NCAA tournament comes out. A lot of hockey left, but it's a remarkable turnaround from the low points that I covered in the 2010s.
Yeah, you definitely covered the wrong era of MSU hockey.
But I also covered the Mason era, too.
That's true. This is very different, and it's fun at the LSJ. It's just different than we've ever had to deal with since I have been there, because I have been there for most of the just dark times, and so we haven't had to really think about hockey as up again, choices for coverage, where we're going to be, when the postseason, how we're going to handle that. There's lots of discussions we're having that are fun. It's great to have it. Women's basketball, people are excited about. I've watched enough of Robin Fralick's team to feel like I have a good sense of them. An exciting brand of basketball. I think that's going to be an NCAA tournament team. They have, the metrics like them a lot. and they've won enough. And I think they'll be something like an 8 seed or 9 seed. Let's talk some men's hoops. Michigan State beats Nebraska. Sorry, not Nebraska. Who do they play? Rutgers. Other team in red.
Rutgers, yes.
Yeah, I'll tell Phil to fix that in post. No, I won't. But the and it's a game where, you know, coming into it, there was a little bit of consternation because they'd have two straight losses. I think some fans out there probably disagree with me to the level in which they had played, because I really viewed the Illinois loss differently than the Northwestern loss, and I thought they had played pretty well in 6 of 7 games, even though one was a loss. You lose by 3 on the road at a top 10 team, and I know Illinois just turned around and blew a game at home to Maryland, but that's not really a problem loss. What made it feel like a problem was all the other struggles early, and that Michigan State's trying to make up for that, and at some point you got to win those games to do so. But MSU is a team that the numbers love anyway as well. Like I see these bracketologies that have Michigan State on the outside of the NCAA tournament. If you look at like Bartorvik projections, if you look at where the net has them and everything, they're going to be like a 6 seed or something like that if they play to their capabilities, maybe even better than that. Unless they really don't take care of business against teams that are less than them, they're not going to be a bubble team. They're just better than that.
Yeah, but that's the if, right? I mean, we've seen this team early on seemingly played down. Well, James Madison is better than people expected. Nebraska has been better than people expected. Northwestern has some big wins, including that somehow only a 14-point win that felt much bigger against Michigan
State.
And a win over Purdue. So, I mean, there's a lot of things there, but you got to take care of the business here, especially this stretch right now. I mean, that loss at Illinois, they played better, and they were in the game, and they were up 6 in the second half. And, you know, it's funny because Tom Izzo talked about that after the Rutgers game. They go up 6 at Illinois on the road in a hostile environment, and then they tighten up, and then they lost that game and let it slip away, let that lead slip away, and couldn't get it back, even though I think they lost by 3 and had a couple shots there at the end to either send it to overtime or win it. But in that Rutgers game, there was a stretch when they went on that, I think it was at that point, an 11-0 run, and they seized the momentum. Rutgers calls timeout, and I thought it was fascinating that Izzo, and it's not like Izzo, and sometimes he brought up that 6-point lead at Illinois in the huddle, he said, during the Rutgers game, during that timeout, right out of the timeout, I think it was the Jamichael Davis kid for Rutgers, takes it back, goes the length of the court, and Carson Cooper takes a charge. Run continues on to a 19-0 run, and Michigan State runs away with it. That was one of those plays that I think, at least from Izzo's standpoint and maybe from the player's standpoint, I think there were a couple points in this game on Sunday where they're going to look at it and say, this is the effort that we need to give and beyond. And that's something that I think was lacking in the Northwestern game.
Sure. The problem I have with the analysis of Michigan State is right now is the Northwestern game is undoubtedly awful. But I think that is the one-off. Like the 5 games before that and the 2 games since it have been good effort performances. They didn't shoot well against Illinois. They did a few things that weren't intelligent on the court at times or whatever. But ultimately, they played hard. It was not for lack of grit and effort. And there were some things that like A.J. Hogard has not had a dip really in play going back to the Nebraska game, even before, you know, the run really started. So I think the fact that you don't have to worry about that as much anymore because he's been consistent and he's the guy who really makes things go. There are things that are flawed about this team, and I think one of the things that is been a positive sign is there is a resolve to them. There is a resiliency, and they don't, you know, both Indiana State and Rutgers were games at home where they trailed in the second half and had to respond, and did, and responded well to win kind of going away. And I think that is you know, that is a sign of a team that can handle some situations where I think early in the year they might have, and in fact we saw it against James Madison, they might have lost that game. I think there were times a year ago, and so that's something, you know, that I think you can trust. The thing that you haven't seen from them yet, Chris, and this is important if they're going to be the seed that I think people want them to be and maybe somehow stay in Big Ten contention, is you have to win road games. They haven't won a single true road game yet, and I think that's also a bit of a concern. And Maryland is a test of that to some degree. Maryland's not an awful team. I don't think they're an NCAA tournament team, but they're capable. They're not a good shooting team. And then you get a game that will really be telling. It's Nebraska, or sorry,
Wisconsin.
Session with Nebraska.
They're also red too. You've got
everybody.
I mean, only one. There's a lot of red teams. They also got a road game at the end of the regular season against Indiana, also red.
That's a red team. That I'll call them Nebraska when we get there. That's a team I like watching even less. that's a horribly constructed roster. There are some rosters in the Big Ten that are really poorly constructed. Maryland, Indiana, Penn State, Rutgers can't shoot. There's some teams that can't shoot, and those are teams that are probably not going to beat MSU. Because, you know, that's just you look at the way the Penn State blowout happened. Like, Penn State could play Michigan State 300 times, and 299 times out of that, Michigan State's going to beat them. But there are positive things. There are some things that are still very much works in progress, and that is the center position for sure.
Yeah.
Well,
it's funny because one of those plays that I was talking about where you might look back and say that's a moment where you saw something from this team was Tyson Walker gets a steal and dives on the floor for a loose ball, and Jackson Kohler, if you want any idea if Jackson Kohler's foot is getting healthy and he's getting closer, you watch him go and dash down the court after a loose ball as it's rolling in front of the sideline and dive for it and try and knock it off a Rutgers defender's leg to retain possession after that poke away by Walker, because that was an effort play. And this is what Tom Izzo talked about a lot, was that's the kind of effort that needs to be a regular thing for this team to get back in it. And I mean, it was Kohler, and I think that's a big thing from a health standpoint from where he was, but you got to see more of that from more guys. I think there are guys that have done that. I think Sissoko's done that at times, but it's got to be more consistent. And that's the consistency piece that he was, even after that game, he talked about them need to get more consistent. You mentioned about Hogard's stretch. Malik Hall, outside of that Northwestern game where he put up zeros in 25 minutes or whatever, he's been really good. And it's a shame that Northwestern game was so bad, because it really it's not the right word, but it kind of masks to people just how good he's been in four of those five games in this stretch.
Well, but part of that is if you're a fifth-year senior, you can't have that game. And he talked about putting it behind him.
I am about 95% positive that Tom Izzo had that. I'll push it up to 99.9% that Tom Izzo had that conversation immediately after the game with Malik Hall.
Yeah, and he sets a tone, and there's no question he's important. He gives them a post presence. He gives them a physical presence. The center position is one that, and I know not everybody agrees with me on this, and there are people that I respect on social media who think that Sissoko is probably better than I do, and when I watch Sissoko, I'm like, that guy should watch tape of Ben Wallace and try to be that, but he's not. And you're 4 years in, and you know, one of the I think the problems they have with him is, you know, coaches and Izzo's will talk about possessions and how important valuing possessions and the late possessions and early and all this stuff. If possessions matter, and they do, they matter a ton, then you can't afford to throw Sissoko the ball in the post, like ever, because that's about an 18% play. You know, it's a turnover. You can't, when you dish it to him and he drops it out of bounds, you know, those are the sort of things.
Unless you put it up on the rim.
Right. And I know that Cooper has certainly Carson Cooper's had some issues hanging on the ball, but hands, for me, like one of the things I liked early on about him a year ago is he was starting to emerge as a plus player at times. Was he had good hands? I don't think having good hands is his problem. He's in some weird situation right now where it seems to be in his head or something. But
man, I'd be working with Cooper and Sissoko all day, giving him tennis balls, throw him off the wall, work on catching him with your hands just to get that fingertip feel that you need. If you have a smaller ball and you can make those catches on that, you should be able to make two-handed catches on a basketball.
Yeah, but right. But one of them actually has good hands and the other doesn't, is what I'm saying. And so there's no correcting bad hands. You can improve them, but you can't correct them. So what I'm curious to see is like Carson Cooper being in the game, as you brought up that charge he took, he helped change that game. And it's not the problem with the center position for Michigan State is Carson Cooper helped change that game. The next game, he may be inferior to what Sissoko's giving them. And Sissoko's really good on ball screen defense. He's a sometimes good rebounder. And then you start to work Jackson Kohler in, and he gives you something else different. I think that there are things offensively that he'll be terrific giving them. I just think when they get Kohler back to a place where I think the next 2 weeks you're still working him in, but once you get past the working him in stage, you have to reevaluate sort of what each guy's giving you, the odds that possessions are going to go well, the odds that you're going to get the rebound, really analyze. And some of it will be matchup dependent. I mean, but I think you got to take another look at that. And I do think for this team to get where it hopes to be, Sissoko probably can't be more than a 15, 17 minute a game guy. And he's got to give maximum effort for those minutes. And I don't doubt it. And you see it occasionally, but when he's relied on for more of that, you know, you see it in the Illinois game I don't want to just beat on Sissoko here because I like Mati Sissoko, but he's a fourth-year guy who I think is on both ends of the court.
Ism was always going to be a project based on when he picked up basketball and when his formal training in basketball began.
Yeah, but the project has to come to fruition. He's a fourth-year guy.
Oh, I completely agree with you, and I think that, you know, there are still late bloomers in this sport. I think Mati Sissoko's best basketball is ahead of him. Don't know when and where it'll be. Could be this year. It could be next year if he's at Michigan State. Maybe he plays somewhere else. Could be by the time he gets to be a pro, kind of like Kevin Willis. You know, I mean, Kevin Willis's years at Michigan State weren't exactly anything to write home about.
He's also 7 feet.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, Sissoko in this game, with game getting smaller in a lot of ways, is kind of a 7-footer. Maybe not the traditional 7-footers as you see, but he is a big man who's got the wingspan and got the capability to do things in the paint with that wingspan that he has yet to really show consistent level. I mean, he played 18 minutes against Rutgers and got 7 boards and still was 1 of 5 and fumbled a pass here or there. I mean, so there are things that you got to watch. I'm curious to see where Kohler fits in, because I do think, I mean, the minute distribution, it was 18 for Sissoko, 12 for Cooper, and 8 for Kohler. That might be the numbers that we see that it might flip somewhere along the way. I mean, for Kohler, it's going to be about, can you contribute on the defensive end? The same with Xavier Booker. And Booker got in early, got a couple minutes early, and, you know, went to the bench in that game after not playing at Illinois. And, you know, there was one point I thought he had a pretty strong rebound in the paint. I mean, but he's still a project too. It's hard to say a 5-star kid as a project, but that's what he is. And that's what he has been.
Very much that, yeah.
And I think this staff knew that. So I don't know. That it's going to be interesting with those four guys to see the minute distribution, because I do think that, you know, Hall gives you some options to go small in the middle at times. And, you know, maybe that's a way to work Booker in to get his 3-point shot for a couple minutes a game. I don't know. It's fascinating to see how Izzo is going to kind of, you know, work in the laboratory and build the chemistry in these lineups with guys who have been, especially with Kohler, having been out since October. I mean, as much as they played together all summer, and in camp, I mean, you still got to reintegrate the guy.
Yeah, and so that's the problem. Like at Illinois, Kohler played, you know, only a minute, but it was sort of a disastrous minute in a game they lost by three. Like, you don't play Kohler, you probably win the game. I would argue, though, if you play Sissoko 10 fewer minutes, a guy who was jumping at three-point shots, you know, when he was supposed to be staying down on the scouting report, who had a couple situations where Illinois had gone small and he was guarding, you know, kind of a, you know, where him being in there didn't help them and was probably unnecessary. I think they win that game. I think they win that. If you take, you know, five more minutes of Cohen Carr and five fewer minutes of Mati Sissoko, I think they win that game. And I think, so those are the things that I want to see them continue to analyze. And I do like, you know, is because Cohen Carr makes such an athletic impact. And in a way, he's not the same player as Aaron Henry. But what Aaron Henry did for the 2018-19 team when he was a freshman was he was the best athlete in a sense. He elevated, certainly on the wing, he elevated who they were athletically. And that changed the whole lineup when he was in the game. And I think Cohen Carr has a little bit of that effect. I don't mind that when he gets beaten on a back door, they take him out. And it doesn't, because those are the accountability things that you have to have with freshmen, because that's how they don't make that mistake in February, March. And it may drive you nuts. It's frustrating at the time, sometimes just from somebody watching the game. But when you don't have that, what you have is what happened with Jet Howard in Michigan, where the team falls apart, where there is no accountability, where you can't play defense, you know, and that situation, you know, you got to hold people accountable young in their careers so they don't make those mistakes, and you can play them more and more. And you saw Cohen Carr play a really strong second half against Rutgers. And, I think that was a step in the right direction.
Yeah, 5 points, four rebounds and a block in 10 minutes. 5 points, four rebounds and a block in 10 minutes. And, I mean, though his two buckets, you know, he had that three. It wasn't the dunk is all well and good, but his finish through contact after he missed his own shot in the paint, rebounded, attacked the offensive glass, and got fouled. That should be a learning point for him as well, that it doesn't have to all be above the rim. Use the strength that you've got, which as a freshman he's got it, and not just solely be reliant on throwing everything down. That, I think, hopefully for him, and I think from Tom Izzo's standpoint, they hope is a learning moment.
The other thing that happened in the Rutgers game was, and I can't believe we're 22 minutes into this, we could have led with this, but we've certainly both written about it, a lot of people have.
Yeah.
Steven Izzo gets his first bucket in the unlikeliest of ways. it was...
That's an understatement, because that play was a Division I play. There's not much more you can say about it.
Well, and to watch as he's doing his crossover move, look at the reaction of Jaden Aiken.
Yeah.
It's my favorite. Like, he does a little shoulder shimmy just as he's doing the move. It's sort of this appreciation of an actual basketball play. Look, it was a lucky shot, but it was a heck of a basketball play, and it went in, and I don't think either of us were expecting it, certainly not in that game.
I watched that shot that he took against Penn State from the logo, and I thought it was in too. And it's funny, because I asked him about it after the game, and he said he's got angles from people in the Izzo zone that they sent him, and he's like, I watched all those and I thought it was in. He's like, it felt good out of my hands, and then, you know, it comes up short. I mean, no, I don't think anybody, I think people thought that this would happen eventually. You know, maybe it's a free throw, maybe it's a layup where the teams kind of conceded. This is a contested shot against a 6'4 dude on a crossover between the legs drive. Didn't have that on any bingo cards.
Yeah,
and
he
was
said
a heck
the
of
shot,
a move and a heck of a moment.
The shot that he missed, that he airballed against Penn State, he had told his dad.
I love that story that he told you guys.
It was like, I'm not going to swear here because this is a Gannett podcast, but I'll use the word stuff instead. His dad was giving him some choice words for being a terrible shot, and he just said, man, that stuff felt good. You know, like, he thought it was good. And,
we have a Taylor Swift reporter, and we can't say the word that he said.
Yeah.
Thanks, Corporate G.
we'll fix that in post for everyone's sake. Anyway, It was a great moment. It was fun to see the reaction of the crowd. It was a real shared experience, I think, for a lot of people. I think a lot of people have been rooting for this moment for a long time. And to see how happy other people were for him and for each other. I mean, just to hearing some of the reactions from fans who were home, who woke spouses up because they were and children up because they were yelling so loud, they were excited. It was something that I think everybody really enjoyed. Now, for people who are also Lions fans, the Lions game sort of superseded everything a few hours later. But it was a moment that I think people have sort of it showed how much people care about Steven Izzo. I think people he has earned that care and respect. His teammates care and respect about him. They do respect him, and it goes back to the original summer that he was, you know, working out with the team and thinking about walking on, and nobody thought he'd last a week or two and went to summer conditioning and he made it. Yeah, and he did. And he is respected among his teammates. And so that was cool to see. It was cool to see the embrace with him and Tom Izzo. And I
never liked the people who jumped on the fact that Tom Izzo put his son on the team as a walk-on. Because, and he explained this, and I've kind of talked with him over the years. He's missed out on a lot of his kid's life. I mean, that's what the profession does. The profession is a grind, and you're missing birthdays. You're missing high school basketball games. You're missing a lot of different things. And this was a chance for him to share something with his son, whether it be as a walk-on player, as he's done now for 5 years, or as a team manager, or any of those things, right? And, you know, there are times, and you know, I'll violate the code a little bit of what we see in practice. There are times where you see Steven Izzo interacting with his teammates, and it's genuine. And there are times when you see Tom Izzo and Steven interacting in the course of his job. It's really nice to see because that's something that it's different for Steven Izzo to watch that as a child growing up and watch it from the sidelines. It's a whole other thing when he's in a practice jersey, standing there and competing and getting the same treatment from his dad as guys like Draymond Green and Denzel Valentine and Cassius Winston and all those guys that he's watched and been around. I'll say this too. And Tom Izzo's a guy who wears his emotions on his sleeve. We all know that. This is probably, there's two moments that I can remember that I've seen him as emotional as he's ever been. One was on Sunday about Steven, and one was standing on the court in Indianapolis at the RCA Dome watching One Shining Moment with Mateen Cleaves. Those are the two moments where he was the most emotional.
Yeah, I don't know if I because he gets emotional. He's an emotional guy, but this is certainly up there. And the other thing, you bring up those names. This is an iconic shot now. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not quite Kenny Goins taking down Zion Williamson and Duke, but it's it's up there. It's a shot that a lot of people remember. It's not because it won a game, but it was meaningful. And I know, you know, there you get to the nepotism point, and there are some people who that really bothers, and that's fair. Everybody's entitled to that opinion. I have sort of reconciled this in my outrage meter. This is not going to be something I'm going to be outraged about because I do. This is a guy who's given a lot of time and given a lot to the university and to Michigan State basketball at the expense of his family, and he saw this as a way to get something back a little bit, and I think that's fair to do. The person who would have made the team the year he was put on it, my understanding, went on to be a walk-on at Michigan. It wasn't like they didn't have any opportunities. And these are not open tryout positions. They're preferred. Well, like Nick Sanders wouldn't be on the team either if it was about basketball. Nick Sanders was not a big-time high school player. The only real walk-on they have is Davis Smith, who's Steve Smith's son too. But he's actually could play like he'd be a decent D2 player. But the other guy, I mean, Steven Izzo wasn't a starter at Lansing Catholic. That's okay. Mm-hmm. It's worked out because he understands his role. He understands that he is in some ways sort of a glorified manager, and he doesn't pretend to be something he's not. And that has been
That's the important thing, and that's why he meshes. And that's why he meshes with those guys, and you know why it works the way it does. And listen, I mean, think about the coaches who have had their sons that they've been able to coach. Boeheim and McCaffrey and, you know, a number of guys other than that have coached their sons. And it's a special moment. I mean, you know, a friend of mine coaches basketball. He's getting to coach three of his kids, you know. Yep. And it's, you know, that's a special moment. It's something that, you know, it's at that college level, it's very, very rare. And, you know, but I thought that, you know, especially when Steven, the reaction of his teammates after that ball finally fell through, and then to have him going over to hug his dad before he shot the free throw, and then making the free throw after he hadn't made a free throw either in his career, you know, that to me was a testament in a lot of ways to his dad. Because imagine if he missed that free throw. I mean, Tom Izzo's known for making free throws, right? I mean, that's a legendary story about him missing a free throw in high school and then shooting them over and over and over again. So it was good to see not just the shot go in, but then the free throw afterward.
So a moment people won't forget, it takes the pressure off him. He talked about that, the relief. You know, it's a moment that people had wanted. It happened. It happened at home. I think that's cool.
Yeah, that is true.
It's out of the way and allows the season to sort of unfold. The greatest, but he's certainly the most beloved walk-on, I would say, of all time. And now what's next for Michigan State is what I think is a really important and determining stretch, because they do need to put some wins together. And, you know, Minnesota is a game, you know, obviously at home on Thursday night. They should win that game, and I think they will. The Maryland game, they need to get a road win. And that's, you know, if they can beat, you know, they obviously just beat Rutgers. If they can then beat Minnesota and beat Maryland and then have a full four-day prep for Wisconsin on the road. And that's a game I think is 50-50. I like the matchup. They've done well at the Kohl Center. But you're 12-7 at that point, 4-4 in the Big Ten, heading into a game where if you beat Wisconsin, if you do go there and win, all of a sudden, a lot of things are at play. Number one, that's a heck of a road win against a team that's going to be in the hunt for a Big Ten title. It's the sort of thing on a resume that's just going to continue to have the metrics love you. But it also allows you to perhaps put together a stretch of games like beyond Wisconsin. Hold on, let me pull this up here. Apologies, should have it there. Beyond Wisconsin, then you get a struggling Michigan yep. team. Then you get Maryland, who you're going to be better than at home again. Then you're at Minnesota. They ought to win that game. Then Illinois at home. Now, that, you know, that's a game that you could lose, but a team at home I think they should beat.
And Minnesota is always a tough trip. You can't discount that just simply because of where things are. I mean, Minnesota has, for some reason, even when Minnesota is bad, playing at the Barn is tough for MSU.
But if you're dialed in, you should win it. And they should win at Penn State, the type of team Penn State is. Then it's Michigan, and Iowa's not that good this year. Ohio State at home. Like, there's a conceivable run for Michigan State if they get past Wisconsin. And this will be a test of focus, because these guys, you know, you do have to show up each and every game. But there's a conceivable run all the way to West Lafayette on March 2nd, at which point, if you've only lost those four games and you're going to Purdue, which already has two Big Ten losses, you know, there is a chance – by then you're still playing for a title. Who knows? But you're certainly at that point playing for a high seed.
And that start to March is going to be important going into the postseason, even if it's just the Big Ten tournament or whatever beyond that, because you got at Purdue, at home against Northwestern, who you already lost to handily, and then back on the road to Indiana. So that's, you know, two of your last three on the road in the state of Indiana is never an easy finish.
And weekend games at Indiana, Sunday afternoon game, that crowd will be rocking, although people are really, you know, who knows what Indiana will be, but that's, you're right, it's a tough game. But there's a chance to get on a real run here. And I think, you know, but to do that, you got to show you can win on the road. You got to prove it to yourself a little bit, because they haven't won a true road game. And so they got to do that against Maryland. And then, you know, you see against Wisconsin. And I look, the first time they played Wisconsin, I think the Malik Hall illness was a real, real factor. Not only did AJ Storr shoot better than he usually does, the wing, which by the way, I love Wisconsin's roster construction and the addition to his team. Yeah. That's why they're that good. That's why they're unbeaten in Big Ten play. But he also shot above his usual level. But Malik Hall is, we've seen what happens when he doesn't play well at Northwestern.
Yeah.
And the game against Wisconsin, he hadn't worked out with him in a week, so he was winded. He hadn't done any of the scouting stuff because he had the flu. So
Izzo admitted afterward he kept him in for too long.
Yeah, and he was sort of playing on instinct from previous matchups with Wisconsin, but none of the stuff he was – and he's also the guy who's supposed to be communicating things to MSU's other centers, and here's a guy who hadn't even practiced to do that. So it was sort of a disaster, a perfect storm in a lot of ways. I still, whatever reason, I mean, I'll probably pick Michigan State to win that game. I just have a hunch. I have a feeling. I think they'll go into Madison and get it done. I think they're more likely to drop a game somewhere along the way that we maybe don't expect or something. But when you look at the Big Ten this year, it is not as deep as it's been. There are a lot. There are games that are, maybe seven teams get in. I think there are four or five strong, really strong teams. It is not as deep as it's been in recent years, and
no, really
there's
isn't.
A chance. There's a chance to put a run together.
Yeah, I listen, that Wisconsin game, an 8 o'clock tip on a Friday night in Madison, is going to be wild. I think that's going to be a circle game. But I mean, playing at Maryland, always tough. And Michigan State always goes there, and it's an event as well. So another weekend game on a Sunday. So listen, there's a lot of basketball left, but it all comes down. And you talk about, I don't know how many times I've heard you say they need to analyze this, that, or the other thing. I was told recently that analytics are phony. So I'm going to go with the heart check on this team. I mean, the passion and energy with which they play and the focus with which they play are every bit as important as any of the analytics, because this team can't coast. This is a team that's shown when it's at its best, it is playing with heart and energy. And you can't quantify that on a stat sheet. You can't quantify diving after loose balls. You can't quantify deflections. You can't quantify the charge that Carson Cooper took and what that does for everybody around you.
But you can quantify rebounds. And I will say one of the things you're starting to see, like they've been a better rebounding team lately, and I think that's important because it's not been a great rebounding team. And that's an area that the great Izzo teams have had. Defense, they've, other than a couple games, have really been able to hang their hat on pretty well. Shooting's much improved.
Yeah, listen, and it's not just the big guys, because Cooper and Sissoko, I think, combined for 12 boards and then throw in six more from Hall, but they got 10 boards out of their starting guards between, and I think the key to improving their rebounding is getting Jaden Akins to, and we talk about the consistency of Malik Hall. There have been points in the last couple games where Jaden Akins is attacking the glass ferociously. Again, one of those things that the numbers, he only had four rebounds. How he got them, when he got them, how he pushed afterward. Those, to me, are things that aren't going to show up on a stat sheet that if you watch the game, you're saying, oh, where's this intensity and attacking more frequently? And, I think that helps everybody else if Jaden Akins continues to ascend in that. And he doesn't have to grab all the rebounds, but he does need to be the one crashing off the wing to get the boards for them and start that break.
So it'll be an interesting stretch coming up. It's about, at this point, you look at their schedule, they have played the toughest stretch they'll play of Big Ten hoops. The fact that Nebraska wound up being really good, Wisconsin, really good, at Illinois, at Northwestern. These are all, of the seven teams that are going to be in the NCAA tournament, or six other teams, I think, that are going to be in the NCAA tournament besides Michigan State. They've played a good chunk, four of them already? So that is telling of their schedule, and you don't know the way it's going to, nobody knows Nebraska's going to be good. Nobody knows Wisconsin's going to be this good. There are things that are just, those are the breaks.
And it's been such a weird year. I mean, was it last week? We saw, I think, all the top five teams at one point lost. So, Izzo's talked about this, and you see it around the country that, I think some of it has to do with not just the transfer portal changing individual teams, but changing how teams are able to scout other teams and, how much you got to really, as a coaching staff and players, completely reinvest in every team you scout, you can't just go relying on previous years. You got to be locked in more because you don't know half the personnel.
Yeah,
you don't
especially early,
things change, you know?
Yeah, early in the season you have to do that, especially when before you really have a sense of it.
But still, it's this time of the year, you can't be reliant, you know, maybe on Northwestern. You knew who Northwestern was because they had so many of the same guys back. But the other guys, the other teams have different personnel from a year ago that you haven't seen that and in a volume that isn't necessarily normal for just advanced scouting. You got to basically, it's a lot for coaching staffs. A lot of times, even if a coach is running similar stuff, the personnel is just so radically different on a lot of rosters that, you know, you got to reinvest sometimes in how much time you're spending on film.
Let's wrap with a little football talk because we have not talked since Michigan won a national championship, which for a lot of Michigan State fans and a lot of podcast listeners is a dark day, dark times. And, you know, I do want to say, though, like that Michigan won a national title to me is – I want to say heartening for Michigan State fans, but that a team like Michigan won it, that they played a team like Washington should be heartening if you strip away the brand, so to speak, because I do think that who Michigan is right now is not very different from who Michigan State was as a team 10 years ago. And that, you know, the Michigan State as a program may never be what peak Clemson or LSU or Alabama have been in their very best years. But it shows, it's, you know, especially now with the transfer portal and I think there's a little, going to be a little more parity and the 12-team playoff will change things even more.
Yes, it will.
That, you know, you can win a national title at Michigan State. We always knew that because the Rose Bowl team could have if the playoff existed. I think the 2014 team, if JT Barrett doesn't have, I mean, they faced a great day for Marcus Mariota and then JT Barrett, you know, playing like the best of John Elway at Spartan Stadium in November. And it was never that good again, or rarely, if ever. That 14 team was capable. So we knew that, and people who watch Michigan State knew that. But I think collectively at large, the college football community maybe, you know, questioned that. And certainly the further you get away from it, there's some doubt. But I just think that the way that happened, if you're Jonathan Smith or if you're a Michigan State fan or you're in the administration, you know you're capable of that because you can – Michigan and Washington did not have the most talented recruiting classes. They had great cultures. They had successful NIL programs that got kids to stick around to try to win a national title. So that's important.
At the moment, it's important. That could change at any point.
Yeah,
let's face it. I mean,
the
NIL stuff is so all over the place, and the NCAA is throwing out new regulations and trying to bring things under a little more control, and nobody really knows where this is going to end up.
Well, the good news for Michigan State is we'll see what, you know, with its own NIL, there's some stuff happening there. But, like, I think with – overall, as an athletic department, Michigan State is a have.
And the absolutely.
Have and have not world.
Absolutely.
And that is something you can, you know, it is so much worse to be an Arizona fan today or, you know, a fan of a lot of other places. And I think college football and college sports are in trouble because of that, because you need those fan bases to care and have the dream alive.
Arizona's financial standpoint is a mess.
Yeah.
That situation is going to be difficult to try and lure another high-level coach. You may need to go a younger, up-and-coming route. Maybe a strike gold, maybe you don't. But their athletic department budget is in tatters at this point.
In trouble.
That's a tough timing to lose a coach that you thought was building that program. But I mean, this is the way of everything right now. I mean, you see. Everything is about dominoes falling right now in college football, whether it be realignment, whether it be the transfer portal. One guy leaves a school, goes to another school, then someone else transfers out of that school to somewhere else. Coaches, you've seen that. The dominoes with Nick Saban retiring, which we haven't even gotten to either. You know, obviously a massive story in college football. And then the dominoes fall after that with Kalen DeBoer leaving a team he led to a national championship in 2 years. Short timers. I mean, it's short timers, and the players then are the dominoes that move with them. I mean, it's head spinning at times, because we're not talking about pro sports where you got 30 teams. We're talking about Division I, Power 5, and beyond college sports where there's 130 teams. And trying to track some of that stuff is mind-blowing with 100-player rosters.
Well, but and the other thing is with DeBoer and Saban, and, you know, obviously Saban, you know, there's a lot of interest in kind of the great what-if at Michigan State, which was helped by Mark D'Antonio's existence that took away some of the what-ifs if Saban had stuck around. But the timing of everything, because that happens later because it's after the playoff, you know, Washington's semester has started. A year from now, when the playoff, until they get the calendar right in college football, and it will eventually. I mean, I think within a couple of years, the season will start a week earlier. You won't finish on Thanksgiving weekend. You know, everything will end about when it does now. But next year, the national championship game is January 20th. So if you think about that and the lack of ability to move for those students and those players after that point, just because you're already, I mean, this is still tied to college to some degree. You got to be in class. You can't.
Is it?
It is.
It should be. It should be.
It better be, because that's the only reason people care.
But if it was, then semesters would matter and the seasons would finish up within the academic calendor.
But they don't
sports.
In hockey, or they don't. That's always been my.
No, they don't.
You know,
they don't. But those athletes, when their seasons are done, stay through to the end of that semester.
That's true.
This is one where the semester begins. There's, you know, all the think about it. Which other sports from the fall semester carry over?
I want to ask you a couple different coaching things. Your sense, Jim Harbaugh, does he, and I know he's interviewed with the Chargers at this point, does he stay or go in your best guess?
I think he goes. I think the J.J. McCarthy situation of leaving and turning pro, to me, although I did see Donovan Edwards is probably going to come back but I think I'd put about an 85% chance that Harbaugh goes.
Kalen DeBoer, 5 years from now, is he the coach still at Alabama, and has it been a success?
I have a unique understanding of where Kalen came from, having been in Sioux Falls when he started his coaching career, and as an offensive coordinator at his alma mater. It was after his playing days had ended, both football and baseball. Sometime I'll tell you the story about baseball, but he took over for a legend at his alma mater who won a national title and won a couple national titles with Kalen on the staff, and continued and built that success upon it. He has an understanding of how to replace a legend at a much, much lower level, much like he had an understanding of how to win at a lower level. Can it translate to replace the best coach in college football history? Is a tough one, especially at a place like, listen, the University of Sioux Falls, God bless the coup, but that's not the Alabama fan base. That's as far from the Alabama fan base as you can get, and they get antsy fast. And they've run many coaches out before this run with Nick Saban, and trying to satiate them to keep them, change their opinion of what they should get and be is going to be difficult. And it's a different area for Kalen, but I do think that when it comes to coaching chops, I mean, if he's able to sustain a good chunk of the recruiting that Nick Saban built and the brand that Alabama built from an X's and O's standpoint, I think he can do that. I think he can keep them atop.
Yeah, and I like coaches who've won everywhere like him. I just think guys have a lot of confidence. You have to have a lot of confidence to play Nick Saban. He knows what he knows how to build a program. He knows what works everywhere. And for a guy who began where he did to wind up at Alabama before he was 50 years old, I think is pretty dang cool. it is a reminder. I mean, he was at Eastern Michigan like 5 years ago. He was at Fresno, you know. I mean, it just is an offensive coordinator before he's the head coach. And then Indiana. I mean, like, it's a reminder to all these ADs out there that, and I'm not saying he hasn't grown as a coach since then, but, you know, Kalen DeBoer may be who Alabama gets today, but anybody could have had Kalen DeBoer 4 years ago. And so, you know, this idea, search committees can't find this.
You want to know a story? One story about him? Both the University of North Dakota and University of South Dakota passed on him. I mean,
yeah,
when he was at the University of Sioux Falls, and he had to go take a coordinator job at, I think, Southern Illinois.
Yep.
To build his resume to get where he's at.
Yep.
And he got bypassed by two schools that were right there, and now he's the head coach at Alabama.
Yeah. I mean, if I were an AD, I would have somebody who was, you know, I'd have a department, if I could afford it, within my department, that just spent all the time scouting, because you never know when it different, you know, volleyball, basketball, whatever it might be. I'd have people scouting young coaches in all the different sports so that you were ready to make hires that were, you know, a little more, you're playing chess when everybody else is playing checkers, so to speak. But that's, yeah, that's my own anti, you know, it's pretty easy to say, I want the best coach available. No doubt. I don't know, watch my language here. But anyway. Yeah.
The guys that – sometimes the guys that can win with less, when they get more, can win more.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, it is good to be back. We will come back next week after and I think we'll have Nate Bott on and talk some hockey as well because it's time. I mean, MSU hockey is surging, and I think there are calls for that, and certainly we're – going to up our coverage, and well, we have been, but
yeah.
You know, the fact that I'm sticking around this weekend rather than going to a men's basketball trip
is
telling of where things
are. Has nothing to do with that Lions game.
You know, I, if the Lions were not playing, would it be a different calculus? You know, maybe a little bit, maybe a small bit. But anyway, we'll have complete coverage of that, and of course the men's basketball game as well. At LSJ.com, Freep.com, and greenandwhite.com. We appreciate you listening. Please rate, subscribe, throw fruit, whatever you would like to do. And we will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.